Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for High Velocity Radio.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, where we celebrate top performers producing better results in less time. Stone Peyton, Lee Cantor in the studio with you this afternoon. How you doing, buddy?
I am doing well because I'm excited about this episode when I saw it on the calendar, and we're going to learn a lot today.
Well, I'm well-fed and excited about today's segment. I had sausage and peppers and butter beans. I got to tell you, the folks downstairs, they do almost as well as Grandma with the butter beans. So I'm fit to be tied, man. This is going to be a fun segment. A little bit later in today's program, we're going to get a chance to visit with the President Regional Director of Murphy Business and Financial Corporation, Georgia, a gentleman by the name of Art Lenig, and he's got some initials associated with his name that we'll learn more about. But first up on the High Velocity Radio Show today, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce, what is this gentleman's title? I had it all up, the Chief Strategy Officer. That'll be interesting to learn about. With Annuitas, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, Mr. Adam Needles. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am doing well. And you do, we said this before we went on it, you've got that NPR voice, man. That is very soothing.
Smooth jazz with Adam Needles.
That's the way I calm down clients very quietly.
So now,
back away from the ledge.
So what are you doing for folks that are new with us?
It's a good question. We have seen a tremendous evolution that's going on in the marketplace around how buyers buy, right? So obviously the internet, whole revolution where increasingly if you're trying to sell something in the marketplace, the buyers have a lot more advantage than sellers do. But what we see in the business-to-business world is that selling models really have not evolved. And in fact, we see increasingly that sales and marketing in the business-to-business environment is really lagging behind. And so what Annuitas does, we work with companies in the Fortune 500 space to sort of re-engineer how they sell and market, how they go to market. And that's not just looking at their processes. It's also looking at their content, their channels, their technology, their organizational structure. And the whole goal is to say, how can we be more buyer-centric in how we engage? How can we not so much push our products and services to buyers, but better understand their needs, better connect with them in the right place at the right time, and use that to really design all of our sales and marketing interactions with them? And so it's very much a consultative re-engineering, whatever you want to call it, but it's helping these organizations get a lot closer to their buyers.
Now, and you mentioned this, that in the past, the information used to be in the hands of the seller.
Correct.
Right, and they were kind of the gatekeeper, and the model was that the salesman kind of shared everything that that person needed to know, and then the buyer would get that information from the seller, and then they would make kind of the best decision they could with the information they had, obviously.
Correct, correct.
Now, I guess because of the advent of the internet, there's so much information out there, the buyer comes to the table with a lot more knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm. They're disintermediating the salesperson.
Right, so now the salesperson's role has to change.
Right.
And you're saying that they haven't, salespeople have been slow to adapt to this?
So imagine that.
Yeah. So it's interesting, in the 1970s, there's a gentleman named Robert Jolus who was at Xerox, their famed sales training academy. And based on all the research and the work they had done, he wrote a book called Customer-Centered Selling. So successful salespeople, I would say, have always been customer-centered, meaning knowing where their customers are in their buying cycle and then keying in on their needs to really move them forward. The problem is that throughout the 80s and 90s, as we got new channels to engage with buyers, we became a little bit lazy and we got this push mentality where we just want to push out emails. We just want to force stuff in front of more people.
Because you can.
Because you can.
And it's cheap, yep. Right? There's no cost. There's, you know, an email is free, basically,
exactly.
Right? So more is better.
Exactly. And so buyers really have not reacted well to that.
Imagine that.
And business buyers in particular really have changed how they engage with that information, the channels. And the problem is in the process, right? You've got 10, 20 years of selling and marketing that's predicated on this push mentality. And there's not really the pull, even though we have all the behavioral indicators, all the systems, all the technology today to actually see where your buyer is. And it comes down to this intent-based marketing and selling, understanding someone's behaviors, their intent, and using that to cue in and respond. And so it represents not only a process redesign, but it also changes your technology, changes the way you leverage that technology. So instead of using it to just push people, we're doing a lot more listening, except that most organizations aren't. And so we're at the forefront of really helping these companies to re-engineer how they engage with their buyers.
Now, isn't some of the challenge that the people who typically are in charge are older and have sold a certain way historically?
Correct.
And then kind of know what they're doing and they have done it a certain way. And then the younger people who have grown up with technology and kind of how they interact with it, they know a different kind of paradigm on this Correct. Interaction. And then, but the older people are the ones that are writing checks and they're in charge.
And so. That's why in B2B right now, you see a lot of CMOs that came from an ad-driven world, an interruptive world.
Right.
And you see a lot of their heads of digital and heads of marketing operations that in fact have come from this new world. And I think we're about to see a real seismic shift. CMOs, I think you know, right, of any animal in the wild, CMOs have the shortest life cycle, yes. right? They churn every 1 to 2 years.
I don't
years.
Know. We do a thing with CFOs, and they seem to think the same thing.
Although I'm pretty convinced CFOs have the complete opposite. They pretty much stick around forever and ever and ever.
So do you find, when you're initially working with an organization, that sometimes, maybe even oftentimes, sales and marketing don't necessarily play real well together?
That's absolutely it. So if you reimagine saying, hey, look, we've got a buyer and here's the process they're going to go through, right? And it's, first of all, it's nonlinear, so you can't make this just a script. And second, it's multi-channel. So all this stuff is not simple. This is really complicated. But to say, hey, we have this buyer who's going through these information stages and interacting, right? How can we get our arms around the total buying process and then redivvy what parts of it marketing needs to be engaged with and what parts sales needs to be engaged right. with? As a value chain, right? And say, we're trying to, rather than interrupt, we want to engage with this information-seeking activity and we want to intersect and influence it and use it to bring it to us and build a relationship with that buyer through the process. I think the key thing is, and this is what I talk about in my book in Balancing the Demand Equation, the push mentality has led to people, hey, let me tell you about my great product right now, right? And they're just pushing messages.
Right, it's not listening. Like they're... It's a monologue, not a dialogue.
Correct.
And it's waiting. They're not listening. They're waiting. As soon as you get done, then I'm going to say my thing.
Right. Let me wait for you to stop talking so I can tell you about my product. But what you just said a minute ago is, in fact, the key, right? We have to re-engineer the entire org model, the interaction model, the processes for sales and marketing around how do you drive a dialogue with a buyer that leads to a successful conversion. Mm-hmm. And so if you reimagine that, it's interesting. Whenever we go through and we work with sales and marketing organizations and work with heads of sales and CMOs and CEOs of large companies to go through this transformation, nobody is not on the same page with what we're trying to accomplish because they say, hey, this makes total sense. And the reason that they're on the same page is that they see so much failure increasingly in sales and marketing activity if it hasn't course corrected to the new buying process.
Right. I mean, what's that old saying? Like half my ad budget I know is wasted. I just don't know which half.
Exactly.
Right. But I think that some of the challenge is that sales and marketing are incented a little differently.
Correct.
Like the salesperson's incented by selling something.
Right.
And the marketing's incented by, I got lots of people kind of in the funnel. Right. So high five me. And then the sales guy goes, well, you have crappy people in the funnel that I can't sell. And then the marketing people are like, well, you're not selling and I'm putting the right people, you know, they're at conflict. They're not working together, collaboratively.
You're absolutely right on. But if you re-engineer everybody around a common process and everybody's working towards the same outcome, and then mm-hmm. you can actually build systems and KPIs against that, then you can actually successfully metric people on, look, you're still not going to say that a marketer who didn't close that sale is going to be responsible in their bonus 100% for the sale, right? Because that was not necessarily fully within their sphere of influence. But could they have 60% of their comp based on getting to a qualified lead or an opportunity and then another percentage to successful completion? Absolutely. And then flip that for a salesperson where, you know, the majority is the outcome, but a minority are other elements, right? It's all about their sphere of influence, what they can successfully add to the value chain and aligning everything, but keeping everybody honest against the outcome. And I think that's really where when I go in and I'm speaking, and I'm, again, we're talking about Fortune 500 companies, I'm speaking to marketers and we're reviewing their metrics and they're telling me about how many emails they sent.
Right.
What their click rates were on their website. I mean, this is real, right? And so then I look at it and say, Okay. Let's
go to Kroger and let's buy some stuff with your clicks.
Right. Exactly.
Let's take all your clicks, put them in a bucket, and we're going to go to Kroger buy some groceries.
That's exactly it.
So are you guys software or process agnostic, or do you have some go-to tools that you will typically incorporate depending on the situation?
So the work we do spans process engineering, process design, organizational strategy, content, engagement channel design, and systems and technology. So in order to accomplish what we're doing, we have to be multidisciplinary, right? If we're saying we're going to orchestrate all this stuff around a common process.
So you got to kind of do what you're telling them to do.
Exactly. Right. And it's, you know, look, there's so many different analogies about how you teach someone, right? But everybody always talks about, like, the, you know, if you're going to teach someone to fish, probably one of the best ways to get on the back of the boat with them and, you know, start casting,
not
you
do
actually
a webinar.
Do it together. Right. Not just giving them a manual on how to fish. So our team, we have a transformation team led by a strategy org that's sort of the hub, and they're in the business of change management. And then they have sort of groups that work with them within our organization that focus in on different areas like technology and analytics and other areas.
And then you want to meet the person where they are, right? Because they're the ones with information now, the buyer. So you have to provide information at whatever stage they happen to be in this process, right?
Exactly.
Well, in this whole change management thing, that's nothing to dismiss lightly, because you can provide the greatest tools, the greatest process, and get the rank and file fired up and behind it. But if you're not working with that those mid-level tiers and really getting them to embrace it, they'll untrain them quicker than you can train them.
So there's two keys to how we work. One is the overall transformation process. So we'll go in through an initial strategy and blueprinting phase where we work with clients to say, let's understand where you are today and where we need to get you to, right? And then get everybody bought into that. Second, we then go through an implementation phase, which is all of those multidisciplinary tracks we talked about. There's a content track, there's a technology track, there's an org and change track, right? And our team is captaining the initiative, but we're actually working in a collaborative, multidisciplinary fashion. So our teams embed with all their teams. We actually work together for sometimes up to a year to go through this whole effort. And then on the backside of that, we work through what we call an optimization phase, which is we don't just turn our clients loose. We then continue to work with them over an ongoing period to look at how they're doing, to measure the change, the performance, and continue to make recommendations. So part of the key is the approach. The other key to that, and you talk about the rank and file and trying to make sure that they're fully getting on board, we close the loop and put in everyone's hands actual dashboards and analytics that map to everything we're teaching, everything that we're trying to get everybody on the same page with. And then everybody can look at and work off of the same common KPIs and goals. So it's taking a purposeful approach to how we transform, but then actually putting information in their hands so that everybody is seeing the effects of what we're trying to accomplish and working in the same direction.
It sounds very holistic.
It is.
And
it is.
Is that the only way that this works, or can they just kind of take a piece of it and implement a piece?
Nope.
It's kind of an all,
it's
or,
all
nothing,
or nothing,
right?
Yeah. And they're big engagements for that reason, right? Mm-hmm. And it requires a major commitment. And I'll say, while I'm really proud of our clients and the things that we do together and we were really successful together, often if we're kicking one of these off, it's probably because you're probably not in the best shape, right? And need the help. And it takes a, I think, enlightened leader and the C-suite to say, hey, we really, you know, we're so far from where we need to be. We really need to go through this transformation.
Now, who is the first person in the company that kind of has their eye on, hey, something may be amiss, maybe we should check out these guys?
Yeah, I think it comes from a couple different levels. Sometimes at a C-suite level, there's direction to say, hey, we're having problems. And then a head of marketing ops or head of demand gen or digital or someone in a sales leadership, particularly like an inside group, gets tasked to go do some research, right? And so, again, speaking to the digital buyer, they go out and they do research looking for us, right? And obviously engagements like what we're doing today, these are ways that we engage with them and get in front of them. On the flip side, you definitely have heads of marketing, heads of sales, and in some cases, CEOs that say, you know, our demand process is broken. We need to change this fundamentally. And that's the other way that we'll connect.
Well, you mentioned holistic. Like, to me, it sounds scary as hell. If you don't have...
It is.
If you don't have a group with specialized knowledge and expertise to guide you through that. And the other thing is, if you don't treat it holistically, I can envision, and maybe sometimes this happens, that the demand gen guy has his trophy consultant.
Yep.
The analytics lady has her trophy consultant. And I mean, they could be rowing in very different directions and at cross purposes if you don't have this thing tied. The whole orchestra could fall apart.
And that's whenever we go in, our, you know, you always look at a firm like ours, say, who's our largest competitor? Who might we be displacing? We usually displace 2, 3, 4 tactical firms that were just vendors they were working with. Right. And then, you know, we come in and sort of take over the overall approach.
And that might be a kind of a clue to who the potential client is if they do have 4 or 5 different vendors and different aspects.
So we're not often in a head-to-head. It's either they're going to do a transformation or they're not.
Right.
I know everybody in the market always wants to believe that they don't have any competition. We do have competition. The competition is what they're doing today, the tactical
vendors.
Right, the
status quo is the
competition. Absolutely. But for us, it is unique. We truly believe, and we're growing like crazy. We were on the Inc. list last year. We're having a really good run as far as the company. I had written a book about this, and then we built the current iteration of the company about 5 years ago. The Nuitus itself has been around for a number of years, but we merged a couple of companies together to build the current firm. And we've had just significant growth because there's so much need for what we do, but there's no other firm that has that holistic change management kind of vision.
And so another symptom, I guess, is if your marketing and sales folks aren't getting along, that's probably a clue that maybe you got
some
problems
in there.
That's a long
list. Yes.
Right.
Yes. They're not just not getting along. It's like moral combat.
Right. That's what, I mean, we've seen that in here. People complain about that. You're not the first guy.
I will say one of the things that's fun about what we do is that we span so many different industries. Mm-hmm. You know, I was having a conversation with someone earlier today. I've interacted a lot in some of my career started in the tech industry. I think anybody who's been in the tech industry for a lot of years or in any industry, you eventually desire to touch other industries, right? My wife had been in the tech industry for about 15 years and recently moved to a completely new industry, and she could, you know, never been happier, right? For us at Annuitas, we span healthcare, technology, media. We're doing stuff in the travel space right now. We cover so many different industries. That's fascinating. And I got to tell you, the things that our clients do and, you know, the business they're in and then what we build together, it's an exciting collaboration because we get to learn so much from them, but they learn so much from us. And so it truly is...
It's a partnership.
It's a partnership,
right.
Yeah.
It's not a vendor relationship anymore.
Exactly.
Now, can you share a story of maybe the company was on a path that wasn't as well it was as it became after you guys started working with them? You don't have to name the name, but maybe explain maybe the circumstance they were in or what
struggle.
What
does it rhyme with?
I think I can say this publicly. One company that we've had a tremendous run with over the last 2.5 years is PR Newswire. And I say that we've certainly been out with some case studies and we've jointly presented with their CMO. Whenever we first engaged with them, their marketing organization was literally sending out promotional emails. Hey, get 20% off, right? Nothing's going to erode your price faster and nothing's going to have... worse impact on the perception that your buyers
are always discounting, right?
Correct. And they were marketing to marketers. Talk about savvy information consumers. Right. Like you can't really pull the wool over their eyes. You know, PR people and marketers are voracious consumers of digital information, right? So we completely turned things around. We went through a whole strategy project. We reimagined the personas and conversation tracks, built a bunch of content that is truly massively multi-channel. It is on the web, it's on social, it's on email. We have so many different ways. And then we took their systems with Salesforce and with Marketo and then their web CMS Clickability, and we built a truly strategic interaction with all those so that their marketing automation, Marketo, is collecting all this information and building a 360-degree profile of the buyer. And then we're sharing that for scoring, for qualification. And we went from this model where it was one-off random acts of marketing to now there's this perpetual engagement. They're just listening. They're churning out record numbers of prospects and opportunities for their pipeline. Year over year, the demand gen efforts that we're working on actually are now double what they were a year ago. They just won Enterprise Marketing Organization of the World out at the Marketo Annual Conference out in Las Vegas this past May, I believe. And have won numerous other awards in content and technology and other areas. And so I think they're a great example of, you know, they were an information provider. You would have thought they would have been a lot more intelligent, but they just had this erosion in how they sell and market. And their head of sales, Bob Seiler, really had a vision and said, we really need to change this. And so he's the one who initiated it. And then they eventually brought in a new head of marketing. We worked with Ken Winko. And he transformed his entire marketing team to say, every single person in marketing needs to be a steward of buyer and buyer journey and of this joint process with sales. And they completely rebuilt the interaction between the two organizations. So marketing used to be a very tactical sales support function. Hey, you know, we're not selling enough. Let's go do some promotional emails and see if we can get like one more sale this month. To marketing is a constant contributor now to pipeline. And it's really impressive.
I want to hear more about this book. You wrote this thing in 2011? You released it in 2011?
If that's what it says in the jacket, yes.
So what compelled, because that is no small undertaking. That what compelled you to invest the time, energy, to commit this stuff to a book?
Yeah, I've gone through sort of three phases in my career. I went through a phase where I was a marketer and then a chief marketing officer in the business-to-business world for one of the largest tech industry analyst firms out there. I felt for a lot of years, like, why are things not different? Like, there's something wrong here. There's problems, right? And so then there was a second phase where I then said, okay, well, to correct this, I'm going to actually go work and actually work for one of the leading marketing automation and marketing technology providers, Silverpop, Atlanta area company, yeah, who was recently acquired by IBM. And I worked with them for a number of years as their demand generation evangelist and head of field marketing. And so my second phase was, okay, so I was a frontline marketer. I know something's wrong. Let's go see if technology can fix that. With all due respect to Bill Nussie and IBM and Silverpop, technology alone cannot fix the problem. It's a great platform. And I'm sure that's part of IBM's hypothesis and their acquisition with their professional services. But technology alone can't fix that. And so I had been building over a number of years, including some graduate work I had done, a sort of POV on, okay, well, so somebody needs a methodology around this. And that methodology grew into this book, Balancing the Demand Equation, which I published in 2011. And that methodology has further evolved into what we call demand process, which is our methodology at Innovatus. And now we have this fully integrative, buyer-centric transformation methodology that it's not about just one piece, not just about technology, but looking at people, process, content, technology, and data. You know, how they all work together and how you need to transform all of them to do a better job at engaging with and converting buyers into customers.
Now, is there a mistake that you see these companies making like over and over, or is this every case is kind of has their own quirks?
I think that there's a number of mistakes. One of them is the tacticalization of marketing engagement, meaning that I'm sending out emails and my list and the information I'm getting from those interactions is not shared with what's going on my web, is not shared with what's going on my social media. It's not so.
Right. Because that guy just read a blog article that said this new software that was going to do this for him is the, you know, magic bullet that's
exactly
going to solve all the problems.
And if you're paying attention to that lower funnel behavior and you saw where that person is and what they're doing, you would have got it. But if you just see that by itself and don't see that that guy was also
so
on your website yesterday.
Blinders.
Exactly. And it's silos, right? And so this guy was on your website yesterday. He actually called into your call center a week ago. You know, there's all this information, right? So all the information is lying out there on the curb and no one's piecing it together.
Right.
So I'd say that's first and foremost one of the most common mistakes that we see. One of the second ones that we see that we talked about a little bit earlier is, and so maybe they're a little bit more thoughtful in their engagement, but the core of their message is still this push.
It's like one blanket message,
yep,
rather than kind of customizing or crafting it to that specific need they have at that moment.
Exactly. Our clients, when they go through their process, we build out a matrix of content that looks at different stages of the buying process and says, let's start with, we don't even know what channel these are in, right? But we know we need to address different issues, different information requests at different channels at different times. So let's lay out all this content, right? And then let's use that as the core logic. And then we're going to thread different pieces into different channels. Because it's interesting, when you do research, and this is one of the core disciplines that we focus on, we do what we call content consumption research.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the head of technology or the CFO at a company. I can email as a financial institution a CFO and send them a research report and get them to engage with it, because they're so used to over decades having financial institutions bring them research, bring them ideas. That's part of the way the financial community works, right?
Right.
And I'm sure that in the next segment here, Art, you can probably talk more about that. But then if I go send a research report to a head of IT, he will never read that. He will never forward that. It will never get opened. He won't even, like, he'll just delete the email, right? So whenever you dig into different personas, different titles, different types of people, right? And we do what we call ethnographic research, meaning we look at their behaviors and how they interact. Whenever you dig into them, you see different content consumption profiles, right? So we're going to thread a whole set of content and then put different pieces in different stages, but then we're going to leverage marketing automation, CRM, to be listening and tying it together so that you say, okay, they just consume this piece in this channel. This is indicative of here's where they are in their process. Then they do another one later on, another one. We start to see a linear motion that, hey, this guy's actually going through an evaluation process, right? And then all of your intelligence, your score and qualification needs to go ding, 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 ding. And if we're back at what we were talking about before, if you had those as silos and you weren't seeing it as one view, or if you didn't have the right message to continue that dialogue, which was a key part that you noted earlier, those are the two pieces you have to have. And that's what in balancing the demand equation. So this was the book that I wrote that led to the methodology that we have in Annuitas. In balancing the demand equation, I talk about the most fundamental core of reimagining how you generate demand is that you need to make sure that your content interactions speak to buyers with stuff that they need to be listening, that they're interested in, rather. And then on the flip side, you need to have processes and systems that then listen to them. It's a loop, right? So that if I send you something based on how you interact with it and what you say to me in response needs to be the basis for a digital dialogue. And this is the crazy thing. Conversation is still happening through digital mediums, but we just don't envision in that way, and we don't build our marketing and sales systems to enable that dialogue.
But when you're having this kind of a dialogue, it, by definition, it means two people, right?
Correct.
Two interactors. Doesn't the buyer, who's an individual, and they're interacting with this large organization,
right,
they're not interacting with a one person. There's like, it's
many.
An organization.
Right.
So like, I'm hitting, you know, this group here, and they know, you know, they're sending me back an email, and then I'm going somewhere else and something different. So I'm kind of lost. Like, how do you kind of manage me and get me engaged as a human being?
This is the $1 million project,
right? But isn't that what's happening? The buyer has a, you know, at one point I'm over here to the left, and then I'm in the middle. Now I'm over to the right, and a different channel in the organization is sending me information, and they each care about me for that moment, but I'm trying to solve a problem. You know, at some point, somebody as a human being has to interact with me and kind of help me, right?
If you go listen to an orchestra, right, there's 40, 50, 60 instruments all working together.
Right.
Right. It's about orchestration, right? And that's what is not happening, is that I'm interacting with your company, and I expect that your company to interact with me in an orchestrated fashion. And it's that orchestration that we're trying to bring to the companies that we work with. How do you get those live interactions, those digital interactions to actually work together around a common process? And a process that, guess what, is nonlinear. So your playbook has to change depending on what a buyer's doing.
Right. Because sometimes you need help, and I can solve things, or I can read and learn stuff on my own at my own pace. That's great. But sometimes I need a helper. You know, I need a human being that's kind of holding my hand and going, hey, do this, do, think this, or know about this. Because I don't know what I don't know.
Right.
And theoretically, your company or the one I'm looking towards for information has some sort of knowledge or information that's going to help me achieve my goals.
Exactly.
But my original instincts are spot on. This is a lot of work, especially on the front end. And you need...
This is why I've lost all my hair. I used to look like Art. I used to have this nice
full head of hair. But presumably the ROI is there when the process is embraced and the methodology is followed and the rigor is observed. And
what you just said is really critical. The way marketing has existed in these random campaigns so frequently has negative ROI. When you change to orchestrate all these resources and work in a perpetual, always on kind of way, and you're constantly engaging and you're constantly interacting, our programs are so massively and exponentially ROI positive it's unbelievable. Like what was spent to get there becomes negligible.
Because it was being spent kind of in a piecemeal, uncoordinated manner.
Exactly. With no connection to any of the outcomes. And it goes back to some of the points you made earlier too, which is that, and so as a process, you know, that you talk about what are the symptoms that lead people to say we've got a problem. And one of them is, hey, our sales and marketing team aren't working together. Excuse me. Aren't working together. You know, this completely changes that.
So now, for your purposes, you're going out and educating, right, about your book and about the methodology.
Correct.
And then you got to find the where people are at. So you, in order to do this efficiently, so when you're implementing this for a person from the beginning, what's I guess their first interaction could be anywhere along those lines.
Yeah, right? we spend a lot of time for me, for our CEO Carlos Hidalgo. I'm the chief strategy officer. Carlos is the CEO. For Jennifer Harmel, who's our EVP and the head of our operations group. For some of our different executives, we're just out there constantly having dialogue with C-suite executives in different industries. We're at different conferences and events. You know, there are different triggers that lead people there. One, hey, I've got a sales and marketing disconnect. Two, excuse me, I've invested heavily in these technologies around CRM and marketing automation, and I'm getting nothing from it.
Right.
Three, and this is one of the most common ones, I don't know what I don't know. I'm doing all this stuff, but I can't show a dashboard to my CEO, or I'm the CEO and I can't show a dashboard to my board. These are the things that are the common triggers. And so people who are looking for answers to that, you know, they're at industry conferences and events and they're talking and they're going out there online and they're looking at blogs and other stuff and they're looking for answers. And so we're, again, practicing what we preach. We're frequently intersecting those dialogues and just continue to have dialogue with them. There are frequently organizations that we work with that before we actually engage with them, we might have had a conversation with them for a year. We might have been talking to them for over a year and back and forth multiple times. But it goes through a little bit of a diagnosis of, hey, where are you? What are your challenges? A sort of a second phase of education about, you know, here's what we need to get you to. And then sort of a third phase that's like, well, what would it take to get there?
Mm-hmm.
And then that process, you know, that's rarely a week. It's usually a couple of months, sometimes right. up to a year.
All right. Where can our listeners go to learn more? And when, where, and how can they get their hands on this book?
So if you want to find out more about Annuitas, we're just at annuitas.com, annuitas.com. You could Google us also. and Balancing the Demand Equation is on Amazon.
Now, is there on the website some sort of an assessment or something where I can see that I'm having some of these challenges?
There's a number of tools, and there's also a survey that we do on an annual basis that is the only survey of enterprise marketing sales organizations on demand gen and some of the disconnects. And it's amazing. One sort of final fact I'll leave you with is we do our annual survey, and one of the questions we ask is about the effectiveness of demand generation programs in an enterprise environment. And our survey 2 years ago had about, I forget the exact number, maybe it was 2.7, 2.8% of organizations said that they were actually effective. So then the inverse of that is like the other 97, 98% were not.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must have been a little scary to it see was. That.
So that means there's plenty of opportunity out there, right. Job security for you.
I love the opportunity that we have.
Well, this has been incredibly, you know, I can't call it informative for me yet because I don't know that I have enough gray matter to wrap my mind around everything we've spoken about. But when I go back and listen to this, so much of what you have said resonates with me, even as a small business
sure.
owner.
Sure.
But also, you know, we've had our fair share of conversations with very senior level people in many of the organizations he's probably working with. And we do see and hear hints of all of these pathologies, all of these challenges
exactly.
you described. This is, I am so glad that we got a chance to do this. We got to have you back sometime.
Thank
man.
You so much. Yeah. I really
appreciate
it.
Do you have a local client that we can have you and talk about how you guys work together? I think that would be an interesting little roundtable.
Absolutely. You know, ironically, for the first couple of years after we relocated our headquarters to Atlanta, we had zero
local clients.
And, yeah, they're all over the world, right?
right.
But we've actually, thankfully, we've got now a couple of clients here in the Atlanta area.
Yeah, so you think that they would come in here and
absolutely.
We could kind of do a roundtable about how, because it's such a, it has to be done holistically or else you're just another kind of
exactly.
tactic that they've tried and it didn't work.
Exactly. Yep. there's some great case studies.
No, I think it's a marvelous idea. I think that'll make for a terrific segment. So we'll make that happen. Thank you. Again, can you hang out with us while we visit with our next
guest? Absolutely. I want to hear from Art. I want to hear what he's got going on.
All right. All right. The pressure's on him now.
Well, he's got to be nervous. I mean, you're a tough act to follow. But,
Very tough act to follow.
All right. Next up on High Velocity Radio, my distinct pleasure to introduce the president, the regional director with Murphy Business and Financial Corporation, Georgia, Inc., Mr. Art Linig. Did you learn anything in that segment, man?
Absolutely, and I agree with Adam 100%. Mm-hmm. In our market, in our world, it has changed so much on how we go to market. It has changed so much on how you work with a buyer. Back when I got started, it was very much advertising in the newspaper. A buyer'd see a business listed, call up, ask about it. You bring him in, you talk to him, maybe look at his financial statement. Okay, he's got some money. He could buy a business. Here's the business. Go look at it. We'll go talk to the owner. Isn't it a great business? Look, the bathrooms are blue and the showroom is yellow. And, you know, you fall in love with it. It's making this much money and you only have to pay this for it. And bam, they're together. The buyers have changed so much over the years. And newspaper ads have basically become extinct in selling a business. It's all done over the internet. Buyers are so much more educated today than what they were 10 years, 15 years ago. So the process of us marketing a business has changed to go to the educated buyer instead of the person that just, you know, woke up this morning and said, hey, I want to buy a business. And
now, then, yeah, so let's kind of back up a little bit and explain Murphy, Murphy Business and Financial Corporation. You're helping people sell their business or buy a business, but either one.
Both.
Right?
Both. Actually, both. We will work with buyers. We will work with sellers. Mm-hmm. We will work with the buyer on an exclusive basis. We will work with the seller on an exclusive basis.
And then these types of businesses that people are buying and selling, are they multi-million dollar businesses? Are they $100,000 businesses? Are they, you know, what range of businesses?
They're all over the ballpark as far as the range. We'll work with people that have a business that's worth $100,000 or more up to multi-million dollars. Mm-hmm.
And then is this a good time to be selling a business? Or is
absolutely. The market has changed dramatically. Back in 08, yeah, there was a cliff and we all fell off the cliff. We couldn't sell a business because we couldn't get financing. One of our biggest vehicles to finance medium-sized businesses is the SBA, Small Business Administration, right? Guaranteed
loans. I thought they were helping us by making the funds available. No.
They were, but in 2008, they weren't.
Are they a little quicker, though, to embrace a loan? Like if Lee and I wanted to go out and buy another media property that's already profitable and has good numbers, are they more excited about loaning money on that than they are if Lee and I say, hey, we're going to start a surfboard company because, you know, I really like the Gulf Coast. I grew up there.
Industry experience is a big criteria for the SBA.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. They are interested in helping you if you want to make that life change and you want to get out of IT and you want to buy a business. If you have related experience, owning a business helps a lot. The SBA is, yes, very pro lending money again. They are anxious to loan money
to
help people. Yeah. The market has changed again. What hasn't changed or what they're not doing today is they're not going to lend money to the stupid buyer on a bad business. So if you don't have the industry experience, you don't have the education or the experience or knowledge to run a business, and it's a, let's say, a C-level type business, it's just barely making money, they're not going to lend you money.
Aren't they going to find it attractive, though, if I not only go to them with what seems to be a viable package? So maybe I found a surfboard company, they are profitable, and I do know something about water sports or tourism or something. And, oh, by the way, I've been working with Art and these guys, and they've helped me vet this company. Aren't they going to find that more attractive than if I just tell them I went out and found this company.
Absolutely.
So that gives me a competitive advantage.
Your resume and the financials of the company are the two things, the main keys that they look at. Your background, can you run a business? Are you qualified? Number one. Number two, and maybe number one, is the business making money? Can it support you in the lifestyle you need? And can you service the debt? And if those things...
And if I tell them I've been working with Art, they go, you're working with Art.
Well, you're not going to have to tell them. You're not going to have to tell them you're working with me, because I'm going to them seeking them out.
Gotcha.
Because we know the people that make the loans and will do the loans. And we know what they want to see. And we're going to take a package to them showing them that you have this ability. The business does make money. The business supports the criteria they're looking for.
So just like Adam was saying, when he works with his clients, they're kind of a partner. You're kind of a partner also.
Absolutely.
So you're going to help shore up some areas that maybe the seller didn't have kind of quite down as documented as well as they could have. And you're going to help them make it as saleable as possible, because you're both incented to do that.
The difference between us, what we do and what Adam does, is you're going to consult with your clients and have them put the processes in place. We do the processes. We get the information from our seller as far as their financials, what the business does, all that. Then we package it up and then actually go out and look for buyers.
Uh-huh.
Once we find a buyer that's interested, we're going to educate that buyer on everything we know about the business. The questions we don't know, yes, we're going back to the seller to get clarified. Once we get a buyer to a certain point, that certain point being they're ready, they're interested in buying this business, then we actually have the buyer-seller meeting. See if the chemistry works between the two of them. See if the buyer sees everything that he expected in the business. Then we're going to go down the street, sit down in Starbucks, Mickey D's, or whatever, and write an offer. Take it back to the seller, present it to the seller, and explain everything that's in the offer so they understand what it means to them. Once the seller accepts it, now we start packaging it up to go to the lender and get the money.
And you're helping at every step?
Every step of the way.
Now, is it ever the case that the person who owns the business thinks the business is more valuable than what the market would bear?
That, I think...
I can't imagine that.
Yeah,
never.
In my 17 years of doing this, I'd say that's happened once, maybe twice.
So now, how off is the person selling their business typically? Like, if they think, my business is worth X, and you're like, no, your business is worth... X divided by 2, 3, 5, 10.
10, 15.
Right.
It happens. I get two responses usually. My business is worth $1 million and it's worth 100.
Right.
Or I have no clue. And part of what we do, one of the first steps in the process is to have a third-party valuation done on the business. And that's done for a couple different reasons. Multitude of reasons. Number one is a reality check for the seller. It's a third party. It's right. Not me.
Has it ever been like, you think your business is worth $1 million? It's really worth $10 million. Has that ever?
Yes.
That's
most
happened
definitely.
Before.
Really? Yes.
Really?
Yeah. So you want to have the valuation done for, again, multiple reasons. One, you don't want to leave the seller's money on the table.
Right.
Number two, you don't want to overprice it because, you'll never sell it. Nobody will ever call. So you want to have pretty close to the right price when you go out in the market so that you do get buyers interested. And again, you don't leave the seller's money on the table, because in most cases, the business is the seller's 401k plan.
Right.
So you want to get them as much money as you can.
Now, what are some tips for business owners in order to get the most out of selling their business?
Good financials.
But, like, is there things they could be doing to improve that in, like, a short period of time? Like, how you paint your house before you sell it? Like, what are some of those things?
Good financials. If you're running two separate sets of books,
right? Because you know, some people are like, you know, they want to tell the government, "Oh, we're not making any money," but then when it comes time to sell it, right? You don't want
magically they're making money when you look at the books. Now that's I want to know about that art. How do we do that?
How do you do that?
I have clients that would like to do that.
We tell the prospect that if you're running two separate sets of books, you know, that's between you, Uncle Sam.
And your Lord.
And your Lord, yes, absolutely. You know, and I make no qualms about it. You know, however, we can only sell what's in black and white.
Right.
You know, because part of this process is the SBA is going to have you sign a form that allows them to go to the IRS and ask the IRS to send the first page of that tax return.
Right.
So if it's not true, we're not going anywhere.
Right.
And we can't get you money. We can't get a government-sponsored loan on the money that you're not paying Uncle Sam. It just doesn't work.
So this isn't a quick process, right? So it's like sometimes it could probably take a year or two to get your house in order to make it sellable.
Yes.
Right. So far, if somebody's thinking, oh, I'd like to sell my business at some point, what's the amount of time that they should kind of realistically give themselves to get their house in order to get the most out of it? So, like you said, it's their 401k. Let them, you know, kind of get the most possible money out of it.
It does take from the time we actually list the business until the seller is totally out.
Right.
It's going to take anywhere from a year to a year and a half is what I always
tell
my clients.
That's like in a best case scenario or a typical?
Typical scenario. Best case could be quicker, yes. Right. Worst case could be a lot longer. In order, based on your question, when should they start to get their house in order? They should start today. And I don't care when they want to sell. If it's 10 years, 20 years, the smart business owners are going to know constantly, day to day, year to year, what their business is worth. The really smart, educated business owners are going to know what they need to exit and when they want to exit. So if their business is worth, let's say, $2 million today, but their financial planner and their tax accountant is saying you need $5 million in order to retire in the lifestyle you want, there's difference there.
Right.
Okay, so don't wait until you're ready to sell it to call and say, I want to sell my business. They find out it's only worth $2 million. Their financial planner saying, you need a lot more money if you want to live in this grand lifestyle. So if you have, you know, a high-maintenance spouse, you better start working on it now.
I'm a high-maintenance spouse. Right. That's me.
So now, when do you want to engage with the person? Like in your case, is it sooner than it's always sooner is probably better, right? Even though that you may not be compensated for, you want to at least start to meet these people in order to build a relationship.
Sooner is always better,
right?
Because we can go in, sit down with the seller, explain the process to them so they understand what they need to do. We can find what the value of the business is so they can really start putting their plans together when they want to exit. We can help them close that $3 million gap. Maybe the best way for them to grow is by acquisition, same as Adam did. You buy different companies, you mold it into one. So now instead of being a $2 million company, now you're a $3 million company, then a $4 million, then a $5 million. So now you can retire. To grow it organically is going to take a lot longer than to grow it by acquisition. Right.
So getting you involved earlier, they can start thinking more strategically for their long-term goal and whatever outcome they desire.
Right. And we can also help educate them on how to keep their financials clean, how to clean up the building so when we do bring a prospective buyer in, it looks okay, at least, to the buyer. And the buyer's not afraid to get out of the car and go in.
Now, speaking of that, it's a tricky part, I would think, is like, do you tell all your employees, like, hey, we're going to be, how do you manage that? That sounds like
confidentiality is huge in our business. And it's also one of the aspects of our business that makes our business so difficult.
That's why you're meeting at McDonald's and Starbucks. Right.
Exactly.
Not at the office.
Now I get it.
Who's that guy with the briefcase? He's looking around a lot.
That's why on our business name is financial corporation, not business broker.
Right.
Okay. And there's a lot of business brokers that have that out there. And
look, I know there's people that work for big companies and they go, oh, this consulting firm's visiting. Then they're like, okay, we know layoffs are going to happen in, you know, next year.
I've been a business consultant. I've been an insurance salesman. I've been the guy down the street that, you know, as a neighbor or something. Yeah. But I'd never go in as a business broker.
So how does the sales and marketing process work for you, though? Is your phone ringing at this point in your career, or do you have some sort of process for going out?
You need a holistic balancing. What is it? The demand equation strategy, I think.
Everybody needs that. If you're in business, you need that. We need that. Yes. When I started, the way we went to market was by letter, direct mail. And the people I started with, I called them one day and I said, direct mail's not working. And their answer to that was, how many letters are you sending out a week? And I said, about 100, 150. Double it was their answer. And I said, okay, so if I call you back in 3 months and say it's not working, you're going to tell me to double it again? And he said, yes. And it's the market constantly changes. I don't care what business you're in, it's going to change. And if you don't stay on top of it, you got problems.
So are you out there educating them? Like, for instance, it makes sense to me that, and maybe you do this, like you have like a checklist for people, even if they're not doing business with you yet, but just to help like the Stone and Leeds kind of get their house in order, or you may have an article or something you put up. Do you do some content marketing, some education?
We do content marketing, email content marketing, and right. We try each month, we'll send out like a big blast email, and we try to put a tip in there on selling your business and what you need to do.
Right.
As an example, are the different types of buyers? You have a third-party buyer. It's the individual that has retired from Coca-Cola. He's got money, but he's too young. He doesn't want to quit working. So he wants to buy a business. You have the private equity groups. You have your strategic type company that wants to buy you. Somebody that may be in the same industry you are, but they're in Chicago and they want to get a Southeast presence. And then you have the synergetic type company, your competitor right here in your backyard. The synergetic company will pay the most to buy you. The strategic type company will also pay more money than it's really worth. The worst case scenario is probably the third party, because the third party buyer is going to buy your business and has to keep everything as is. He doesn't have an office. He doesn't have a warehouse. He doesn't have 20 vans on the street. Whereas the strategic type buyer, your competitor, is doing the same thing. So he's going to buy you and eliminate half to three quarters of the expenses on your P&L statement. So the business is worth more money. It's generating more to the bottom line. So he can pay more for it and everybody's happy.
So a question I have as I've been listening, what industries are really getting the higher valuations? Where's a lot of the traffic? Is it in retails and technology? Like, what are the segments that you're seeing that are really getting a lot of traffic?
The ones that get the most traffic, most people are interested in. Everybody wants manufacturing. It's just the first thing they ask for. The ones that end up selling the most are service industries. And the advantage of service industries, you have less money tied up in capital expenditures. You don't have the big machines that produce things. You have the individuals. You might have the guy that goes out and washes the windows. You have the little van that he uses to go out and wash the windows. So you're producing, let's say, $2 million in revenue, and you've got $100,000, $150,000 in assets, whereas the manufacturing company producing $2 million in revenue has about $1.5 million tied up in assets.
Oh, wow.
Big difference.
Yep.
Okay, so your return on investment. And a lot of that goes back to what you're saying, the buyers have changed. What I'm saying, they're a lot more educated. They want to know that return on investment. If I'm going to invest my money, what do I have in capital expenditures each year? What kind of return on investment am I going to get, et cetera, et cetera?
But so, now from a lending standpoint, the lender is more apt to lend to the manufacturer that has all this stuff so they can buy stuff as opposed to the service business that doesn't have any real stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
That's the catch-22.
It is a catch-22.
He's writing a new book called Art's Dilemma. That is the core of it right there.
The lending institution, and a while back I said our biggest vehicle for lending is the SBA. Fortunately for us, for people who want to buy a business, the SBA lends on cash flow versus asset value. Your typical brick and mortar bank lends on
assets.
Well, they look at you and it, you guys, you want to buy another radio station? You've been doing this for how many years? You're still going to fail. That's how they look at you. So when you fail and we want to come in and take all those assets back, what can we sell them for? And that's their thinking. And it's been that way for years and years and years. The SBA, which doesn't lend money, it just guarantees the loan to your brick and mortar lending institutions, will guarantee that loan to the tune of 75%. So if you do go belly up, the SBA is going to swoop in and cover that debt that's not been paid to the tune of 75%.
Incidentally, what does that track record look like? Do they do okay, or does the SBA lose on that over time a lot, or they have a pretty good track record?
I think their track record is getting better.
Yeah.
Okay. Go back to one of my first statements. One of the biggest things they look for is industry experience.
Right.
Because they've kept records over the year, and one of the biggest failure rates was with people who did not have industry experience. So they've learned by some of those mistakes. So it is tightening it up somewhat. However, we're all the same. We're all salesmen. We want to close the deal. The lenders are salesmen. They want to close the deal. They just want to do it in a more intelligent and more safe way today.
So you just mentioned a moment ago, Adam, and maybe partially in jest about a book, but I got to wonder, like, a guy with your experience and expertise, is there a book in you? Do you think you might write a book someday? No.
Don't write a book, Art.
No.
you'll be divorced.
I'm not going there. You can tell how much I talk when you ask one question. My book would be so it would take me 10 years to write a book.
But you are obviously the guy for someone to sit down with and ask these questions, so because you do have the depth and the breadth to help someone think this through on either side of this buy-sell
absolutely
equation.
And part of what we do, you know, and I said it, we're all salespeople. I think everybody's a salesperson. And you have to be somewhat of a salesperson to accomplish what you want to accomplish. But it's not the old used car salesman or carpet salesman kind of mentality. It's the consultative type selling and helping somebody walk through. In fact, one of the marketing pieces I use when talking to a buyer is I have a maze, and the buyer's at the beginning of the maze, and the successful closing of the business is at the end of the maze, and helping them get through all those traps that pop up. One of them, as I call it, it's FFDB, family, friends, and drinking buddies. And, you know, hey, I'm going to buy a business. You're going to what? How stupid are you? You're going to use your 401k money to buy a business? Are you nuts? And just helping them get through all that stuff, finding the financing, knowing if the business is good or not. Does it have a good return on investment? Is the equipment bad? Are they playing games with the financials, and just what is it, and helping them through?
Art, there's a number of Fortune 500 financial firms that could learn a lot from you because they're not doing that with their customers. That's fantastic.
It is amazing how many people out there have a business and they have no idea how to work the business so that it can sell later on. And a lot of them don't even know they can sell their business.
Right. That's funny.
Yeah. What do I do? Just shut it down?
Right. And leave.
Yeah.
Give somebody the keys and walk away. Yeah.
Go to Craigslist and sell off the assets. What do I do?
Right.
And it's amazing because you take a service business and just pick a number, $1 million, $2 million in revenue, whatever, what the value of that can be. And if they just sell off the assets on Craigslist, they're going to get virtually nothing.
Right, because they're not hard assets. They're intellectual property assets.
Yeah, a lot of them are.
Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
I appreciate you having me here.
Now, if somebody wanted to learn more or engage in a more substantive conversation with you, is there a website?
Yes, there is. They can go to murphybusiness.com/Georgia, or they can call me at 770-303-0044.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on High Velocity Radio.